Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Lopez versus the City of Chicago. Mr. Kanowitz.
May it please the court, counsel. Your honors, in our profession, we often use short snippets of Latin phrases as shorthand to remind us of various legal doctrines, to put us in the right mind frame of how we're supposed to view the evidence, or even for this court to put it in the mind frame of how it's supposed to view what happened in the lower court. There must be, in Black's Law Dictionary alone, there's probably hundreds of pages of these Latin phrases. But to describe for you what happened in the district court, I need to borrow a Latin phrase from outside of our profession, because what took place is foreign to our profession. It's foreign to our Constitution. It's foreign to how trials are conducted in this country. The phrase I want to borrow comes from the field of theater, specifically Greek and Roman theater. And that Latin phrase is Deus ex machina. Literally translated, it means God from a machine or God being lowered down on a crane. And what it comes from is when the Greek and Roman playwrights had written a play and the characters had taken the actions that they had taken and said the things they had said, and the playwright didn't like where that play was headed, didn't like the logical and natural outcome from what had occurred in the course of the play, they would write in a deity, lower them down on a crane, and have the deity change the course of what was going to happen in the play. And that is a good analogy for what happened when the district court granted a directed verdict in this case. The evidence as it came in justified sending this entire case to a jury, and it doesn't matter whether you apply the Fourth Amendment or the 14th Amendment. The evidence, if you just take the undisputed evidence alone, this man was held in a police station without seeing a judge for 5 days. He was locked in a room essentially the size of a closet for 4 days, where there was no place to sleep, where there was no place to relieve himself. And one of the largest undisputed facts that loomed over the case is after 3 nights in that room, he confessed to a crime, a murder that everyone agrees he did not commit. That's undisputed evidence. Then if you look at the disputed evidence, which the jury was entitled to believe, he claimed he was shackled for those 4 days to a wall. He testified that he was not fed other than once after he gave the confession. He testified to his sleep deprivation. And the jury was entitled to decide that case. The Seventh Amendment, which is a bulwark of how trials are supposed to happen, civil trials in our country, said the jury should have decided that case.
One of the things the city says is that he never asked for food or water.
Well, that
so
is...
How does that strike you?
I didn't take much weight from that statement, Your Honor. The fact that he didn't ask for food doesn't mean that they weren't intentionally starving him. The way that the debate was framed about this, about the food issue, Your Honor, which happened in discovery, they cast their lot, they made a decision. Their story was, we fed him. We didn't follow the usual procedures for how someone gets fed in the Chicago Police Department, which is that they get fed in the lockup. You take them to the lockup from these interrogation rooms, and you leave them there, and they get fed. Or you bring up a sandwich from the lockup. You follow the usual procedures, and someone else inside of the Chicago Police Department documents that he was fed. They didn't go that route. They said instead what we did is we bought him food with our own money and brought it in from outside of the police station. Therefore, there is no documentation of that feeding. The dispute that went to the jury was them claiming he fed him and Joseph Lopez claiming I was starved. And if the jury disbelieved the story they had concocted about the feeding, then the jury was certainly entitled to believe that this was a malicious act of starvation. If what they really wanted to, if their genuine defense was this diffusion of responsibility defense, which is there were four of us, we were in charge of feeding him, we each thought that the other three was feeding him, that's what they would have testified to at their deposition, that's what they would have testified to at the trial. But if they had stood up in front of a jury after the evidence that came in this trial and said, we didn't know he was being starved, the jury would have scratched their head. Because that doesn't coincide with what really happened in this case. It doesn't coincide with what the evidence really was. But they didn't have to stand up in front of a jury and explain themselves because Deus ex machina intervened. There was a directed verdict. And the directed verdict, I want to make very clear that the legal standard that applied to the police officer's conduct here, be it one of reasonableness under the Fourth Amendment or be it one of punishment under the 14th Amendment, the evidence was more than sufficient to put that case to the jury. We're not shying away from a deliberate indifference standard. We think we can prove deliberate indifference to a jury. We think we can prove malicious intentional intent to torture.
But doesn't it make more sense to evaluate the conditions of confinement under that deliberate indifference standard, which is the standard we've used normally for pretrial detainees?
Well, I guess I would have two points on that. First of all, Mr. Lopez was not a pretrial detainee. Pretrial detainee.
And I understand that, but that's the closest situation to what we have.
Well, is that the closest situation? Or is the closest situation a person who is in police custody who is contemplated is going to be brought to the custody of a court in a short period of time? Is that what's closer to the situation? Or is it really closer to the situation someone who is a court has said is, you're going to have to sit in the custody of a jailer for a period of time until your trial? I think it's much closer to the person that has been arrested by a police officer whose duties do not normally include the care and feeding of arrestees, because it's not supposed to, because what's contemplated, the role of a police officer, has been since long before the Fourth Amendment, is arrest the person and then turn them over to the custody of the court. The purpose of an arrest is to bring someone before a court. And so, in my opinion, it is properly viewed under the Fourth Amendment. And if you look at the text of the Fourth Amendment, I don't think we can escape the fact that it's properly viewed under the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment regulates searches and seizures. And the term that's important here is seizure. And the Supreme Court has said, and this court has said many times, a seizure lasts from the moment of arrest until the Gerstein hearing. That's the period of time that we were talking about for when Mr. Lopez was treated as he was treated. And the Supreme Court has said, seizures must be reasonable not only in their duration, but in how they're carried out. That's Graham versus Connor.
Okay. Well, when we look to whether or not there was continuing probable cause, do you agree that if it was continuing probable cause to detain him past 48 hours, that he really didn't suffer an injury on his unlawful detention claim?
I don't agree with that at all. I understand the difference between probable cause at arrest mm-hmm. and continuing probable cause. And we could take an issue with whether there was continuing probable cause here at all. I mean, what we said to the jury is a serious crime was committed and it was okay for the police officers to take him off the street. We never said to the jury it was okay to hold him as long as they did or to treat him the way they did. But of course he suffered damages from the unreasonable length of his detention. He suffered damages in the fact that he was held in a closet for 4 days when, had they followed the usual procedures, which is turn custody of this person over to a court so the court can assign, assuming the court is going to deprive him of his freedom, assign custody of him to an officer of the court, the sheriff, which is the usual procedure and has been since long before the Fourth Amendment was enacted, he would have been in the custody of the person who was disinterested and had only an interest in caring for him. And we see that even already in the Supreme Court's jurisprudence, because delays that are motivated by ill will, and certainly the intent to torture is a delay motivated by ill will, violate the Fourth Amendment. So this fits well within his damages, both historically and in the current jurisprudence. And that's only one type of damage that he suffered. Even if you give them their Carey v. Pipus argument, which would analogize the duty to bring the arrestee promptly before a court only to procedural due process, would say it's nothing more than a procedural due process right aimed at correctly arriving at whether probable cause was decided by the officer. Even if you give them that, Carey v. Pipus is clear that if the government owes you procedural due process and they purposely deprive you of it, and even if the result would have been no different had you received the procedural due process, the distress, the mental distress associated with knowing that the government will not respect your rights is compensable injury. And that is a very apt situation for Mr. Lopez, kept in a room for 4 days for a crime he did not commit, led to believe that his rights would not be respected, shackled to a wall despite being asked to be released, and I could go on. That person had every right to know that the government was going to expect to respect his rights, and the government wasn't respecting his rights. And what Carey v. Pipus was getting at in terms of saying you're entitled to emotional distress for the government refusing to respect your rights couldn't be better exemplified here.
Well, as I understood the theory of your case, or at least this aspect of your case, it's that if your client had gotten his Riverside Gerstein hearing promptly within the 48 hours that Riverside requires, that he then would have been moved out of the tiny interrogation room and into the general population, subject perhaps to further interrogation, but he wouldn't have been housed in that room for the additional period of time. and that that's the gravamen of the offense. Not that, that probable cause would not have been found had he gotten that hearing, but that it was the conditions under which he was being kept that would have been altered.
We're not going to speculate as to whether probable cause could have been, would have been found at that hearing. It is certainly possible that it might not have been, particularly given the fact that he would have been brought to a judge before a prosecutor was even willing to approve charges, and that might have caused the judge to conduct a different hearing and ask about more facts. And oftentimes these probable cause hearings are, you know, based just upon the arrest report, but that might have caused. But that is not the argument that we're making. It is true that he would have been. It's not just moved into a general population. He would have been taken, as the process is supposed to run, from the custody of the police to the custody of the court, and in this case, that would be the Cook County Sheriff. And that is an important difference here, particularly when his needs would have been met as a court requires. When someone is going to be detained for a long period of time, and that is a form of the damages. There's the Carey v. Pipus damages, and there is some debate over whether or not he could have made bail, which would have actually released him from custody entirely. And then I guess yet another kind of damages that I would like to just briefly mention are damages associated with the fact that even if there is probable cause, police cannot detain you forever. At some point, they have to either bring you before a judge or let you go, and that's this court's Laguna versus Mingy case. And that's a case where perfectly lawful arrest, a man is held in custody for 40 hours, but well after the prosecutors indicated they were not going to press charges. And the court said, we're going to remand for damages for the amount of time that this person was detained, past when it became clear that there's not going to be charges, because in our system, you don't detain someone in order to investigate them. You investigate them first, and that's what happened here. I mean, the prosecutors were there every day. They did not approve charges until the fifth day, and instead kept saying, go get more evidence, go get more evidence. Prosecutors all on the stand said, I never told them to hold the guy. They each, you know, disavowed that they had anything to do with the fact that he was being held, where he was held, how he was held. But they kept telling the police, go get more evidence. And you can't keep someone in your custody without consulting a judge while you go continue the investigation. And so there is the additional form of damages for how long he was held past the point when they should have either released him or taken him to a judge.
Mr. Kanowitz, does the record reflect that there was dialogue all 4 days between the petitioner and the police officers?
Between the...
petitioner and the police officers, the plaintiff.
Oh, between Mr. Lopez and the police officers?
Mm-hmm.
They, from the police officer's side, they do say that they interrogated him each and every one of those days. Mr. Lopez, trapped in this room with no clock, no window, no ability to sleep, lost track of time. So he remembers events, he remembers snippets. He cannot lay out a timeline.
Want to reserve some time?
I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kenwood. Ms. Casper.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The District Court entered judgment as a matter of law for the defendants. As we explain in our brief, we concede that Mr. Lopez is entitled to a new trial, or to a trial on his conditions of confinement claim insofar as he claims that he was handcuffed to the wall. Of the interview room, but the judgment should be affirmed on the balance of Mr. Lopez's claims. This morning, I will first explain that Mr. Lopez's conditions of confinement claim is properly evaluated under the 14th Amendment. Next, I will explain why under that standard he adduced no evidence of deliberate indifference. And finally, I will explain that Mr. Lopez is not entitled to damages on his extended detention claim. Mr. Lopez's claims about how he was treated while he was in the interview room should be evaluated under the 14th Amendment. The 4th Amendment is concerned with unreasonable seizures such as arrests that were made without probable cause or arrests that were made with excessive force to take the person into custody.
So is it your position that we should not look at the totality of the circumstances under which he was being held? Or should we just look at each act in isolation?
I would say that Your Honor should evaluate the claim in terms of what is actually being complained about. And he is complaining about the conditions of confinement.
So we look at the totality of the circumstances.
Of the conditions that he was subjected to. Of course, In this case, we do explain that as far as the claim that he was not provided with food or given bathroom access, we make the argument that he adduced no evidence of deliberate indifference in that regard.
Well, isn't there an obvious risk of harm to a detainee if they are not provided with food and water over the course of several days? And it really shouldn't matter, should it, that the person doesn't ask for it? I mean, I understand that's the officer's position and that's your position. I mean, wouldn't a reasonable officer know that it would be a serious harm not to provide food and water?
Certainly he would, Your Honor, if he knew that Mr. Lopez was not being provided with food by anyone. But there is no evidence in this case that the officers knew that nobody was providing him.
So for 4 days, nobody knew he was being fed.
There's certainly no evidence that they knew that Mr. Lopez was not being provided with food by anyone.
And for 4 days, they didn't talk about water or... I mean, it just didn't come up. I mean, they thought the other one did it, and nobody talked to each other about it.
Well, and of course, the officers did testify that they did feed him, but of course, as the case comes before the court, we do assume that Mr. Lopez's testimony we take as true, but as far as it goes, which is only that he did not ask for any food or water. He never claims that he told anybody that nobody was providing him with any, and there's no evidence, even circumstantial, that the officers did not or knew and simply ignored that risk.
Well, wait a second. The officers were responsible for his care and custody, right?
Yes, of course.
And if the jury believes the plaintiff's testimony that he was kept for 4 or 5 days with no food and water, isn't it a reasonable and permissible inference that they knew about that?
No,
since they were responsible for his care?
No, Your Honor. Our position is that if the jury did not believe the officers when each one of them testified that they were bringing him food, then that would establish that they were not bringing him food. It doesn't say anything about what they knew that the other officers may or may not have been doing. That inference does not flow from that.
That sounds like a jury argument to me.
Well, Your Honor, we submit that the evidence... that no evidence was presented as to the officer's knowledge at all, and therefore judgment is appropriate when there's an absence of evidence
well,
such as
let me ask you this and put a different way following along the question that Judge Sykes asked. Why would it be unreasonable for a jury to conclude that it was outrageous conduct to shackle someone to the wall for 4 days with virtually no food or water, with limited bathroom access, and that the whole motivation for that was to force a confession? I mean, why would it be unreasonable for the jury, based on the evidence that had been presented to them, for them to conclude that?
Because the evidence wouldn't support that conclusion. If the evidence supported everything you just
said. But if they didn't believe anything that the officers said about that, and they believed the plaintiff...
And there's still no evidence that would suggest knowledge on the part of the officers. For example, with regard to the bathroom access, Mr. Lopez, on page 145 of the transcript, testified that it was by his choice that he asked once to go to the bathroom, and that when he asked, he was taken. So there's simply no evidence of any that he was even denied that. And as far as the food, there's certainly no evidence. Again, that of any knowledge on the part of the officers with regard to what the other.
And in terms of the room where he was, I mean, it's not disputed that there was no clock in there, is it?
No.
So, I mean, he was in the room. There's no clock. Because he was in custody, didn't have a watch or anything, correct?
That's correct.
So it would be very difficult for him to keep track of time, wouldn't it?
Perhaps so, Your Honor, but he testified very clearly as to what he asked for and what he did not ask for, and did not qualify that testimony.
Well, doesn't that, in fact, support the inference that he was not fed?
Mm-hmm.
He was there for 5 days, 4 nights, asked for bathroom privileges once.
And if
their testimony was that they were feeding him constantly?
Your Honor, as this case comes before the court, we cannot take the position that Mr. Lopez, that the officers were bringing him food all the time, because Mr. Lopez says they weren't. We don't disagree with that. But what deliberate indifference requires is knowledge on the part of the officers that Mr. Lopez was not provided with food. And the fact that he...
My point is that it's a logical inference that if they knew that he asked to go to the bathroom once over 5 days, that they also knew that he wasn't being fed or given water.
And if each and every one of them knew that he had only asked once, then maybe it would be
different. Well, what is the state of the record on that?
There is no evidence of that either. There is absolutely no evidence that they each and every one of them knew that he had only asked
to go to
the bathroom.
Somebody let him out, right?
That's right, but all four of them weren't in the room at the same time all day, every day for four or five days.
We have knowledge on the part of one of them, right?
We have knowledge that somebody took him one time when he asked. That doesn't show that he was not taken at other times or that he did ask, that he knew, that they knew he wasn't being taken at other times. And he says he didn't ask at any other time.
Okay, what about the Riverside violation? It's your burden, right?
Just to be clear, we are not, we do not take the position that the reasons the district court relied upon in this case for judgment as a matter of law on that claim would justify a detention beyond the 48 hours. Our position here is that a violation of that rule is not a constitutional violation, and that even if it is, it's not actionable under Section 1983 in damages. And that is because, again, going back to the core of the Fourth Amendment, it's to prevent unreasonable seizures, seizures that were made without probable cause. And that interest was not offended here. And when the core of the Fourth Amendment is not offended, there should be no damages remedy under the Fourth Amendment either. Of course, here, the Fourth Amendment was not offended because Mr. Lopez, as a starting point, does concede that he was arrested with probable cause. And it seems that he is not seriously claiming, anyway, that anything changed that such that the Gerstein hearing, if it had occurred within 48 hours, would have resulted, that the finding would not have been a probable cause at that hearing as well. Of course, he had already been identified by four people in the first 48 hours. And therefore, because he was both arrested and detained with probable cause, the Fourth Amendment was not offended in this case. At most, the violation would be redressable by an award of nominal damages because Mr. Lopez suffered no injury resulting from this violation, this technical violation of Gerstein.
So sort of getting back to the officer's responsibility, we have almost a situation where if officers detain someone and basically don't ask about the condition of the detainee, that is, whether he's gone to the bathroom, whether he's food, and everybody just kind of runs around in their own world, then it's okay to detain someone in this way and not provide water or food.
Your Honor, if there were...
I mean, isn't there some responsibility to communicate that? I mean, we don't have any testimony that any of the officers... I understand they're saying that they fed him, but right. I just don't understand why this wasn't a jury question.
The reason it wasn't a jury question is because, again, there was no evidence of knowledge. And the reason there is no burden under the deliberate indifference standard for the officers to inquire. That's not to say that if there was a risk they knew about and they stuck their head in the sand, that wouldn't be deliberate indifference.
Well, isn't that this kind
but
of
that,
situation?
No, this is not that case, Your Honor, because there is no evidence that the officers had knowledge that of Mr. Lopez's claim that he was not being provided with food and that he was not being permitted to use the bathroom. And, in fact, he doesn't even support his own claim that he was not permitted to use the bathroom.
So I guess this is maybe going beyond the record, but is this a common practice in this district to keep people for 4 days?
Your Honor, in this case, there's no policy claim. That claim, the district court ruled that if there was, based on the city's motion, that...
No, I'm asking that in terms of the officers and their knowledge. You know, I understand we don't have a Monell claim, but in terms of their knowledge, is this like a practice there, you know, or is this an unusual circumstance?
Well, Your Honor, that certainly would go beyond this record. There's certainly no evidence in the record that that the officers, you know, that there's a practice of not providing people with food or water. I mean, there's no evidence like that in this record.
Now, these officers, as I understand it, did not bring any food until a state's attorney had appeared? Is that right? Was there anything in the record to indicate that he had any nourishment prior to the prosecutor arriving and having some exchange? It's not clear to me.
Well, there's evidence in the sense that the police officers testified that they were bringing him food all along. I understand that, you know, as the case comes before the court, Mr. Lopez says that he was not brought any food until that time. So, yes, there is evidence in the record.
But the officer's timeline would suggest, you're saying, that food was continuously supplied. That's there during
that's
the
right.
course of the 40.
Yes, Your Honor. For all of these reasons, Your Honors, we ask the judgment of the district court be affirmed, except as it relates to the claim regarding shackling.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Gasser. Mr. Kanowicz?
Let me begin back with the issue of feeding here. There's a few points I want to make. First of all is, and we stand absolutely firm on this, the fact that the police officers came in and went with the story that we fed him. If a jury disbelieved mm-hmm. that and they found Mr. Lopez more credible, as they were certainly entitled to do, the inference is that they are covering up a malicious act. And that is a perfectly valid reason to go to the jury all by itself. Let's deal with the issue about the fact that he didn't ask. I want to remind the court, the entire evidence in this trial was he asked for his rights on several occasions. He asked to be unshackled from a wall. He was told no because he was a murderer. He has to make a phone call. He's told he'd get a phone call when pigs fly. You can't treat someone that way and then fault them for not standing on their rights. He did try. It didn't work. And a jury was entitled to believe him. Thirdly, Chicago is trying to tee this up as an issue of whether or not they actually knew he was not being fed. Unfortunately, that's not what the deliberate indifference standard requires. Deliberate indifference standard requires that they take woefully inadequate action when faced with a serious risk of harm. And that was the case here. There is a procedure in the Chicago Police Department to make sure that people in custody get fed, and that is you take them to the lockup where they get a bunk, where they get a cell with a bathroom in it, where they're provided water, where they're fed, where there's phones, where they get to make their phone call. That's the procedure. They yanked him out of that procedure. They kept him upstairs in a closed room for 4 days. They knew that there was a serious risk that his human needs were not going to be met unless they took particularly good care to make sure that they were met. And they can't come in with a diffusion of responsibility argument, you know, particularly not in light of the fact that they already locked into they fed him, but they can't come in now after the close of evidence with a diffusion of responsibility argument and say each of us thought that the other three were feeding him. They each had a responsibility to make sure he was being fed because of the fact that they each knew that he was being kept out of the lockup, and that's more than sufficient for a jury to find deliberate indifference.
Mr. Kanowicz, what is your take on the the trial judge's statement that under the circumstances based on the undisputed evidence in this case showed that Lopez's lies and extraordinary circumstances that were occurring during his confinement no reasonable juror could find. What do you take his phrase, Lopez's lies and extraordinary circumstances, to mean?
Well, it feeds into the theme that defense counsel opened up in their opening, which was that Mr. Lopez was playing games with the police. I mean, they were confronted with evidence of a confession that they got that they had to come to trial and admit was false, and they had to explain how this false confession occurred, and the story they decided to run with was playing games with the police. And when I heard that come out of defense counsel's mouth, I was elated, because we had 8 jurors who were going to listen. They listened to a week and a half of evidence. Many of them had college degrees. Many of them had advanced degrees. They weren't going to fall for that. And it turns out that the district judge did. The district judge decided to adjudicate facts. And what are the three things that he's talking about, Mr. Lopez's latest lie? The first is the false confession, which he says justifies a delay past 48 hours, even though it didn't occur until 57 hours. It was a day and it was a half a day later.
It was the third night, right?
Yeah, the third night in the room. So it can't possibly justify a delay before 48 hours. Plus, I mean, the view that the district court took of that confession was what defense counsel was prepared to argue for the jury, but it was for the jury. It was not for the district judge. And
but when he speaks of lies, it's in the plural, so is there something beyond the confession?
He's talking about three things. He's talking about the confession, which I don't think is fairly characterized as a lie, and certainly that was up to the jury, not to the judge. He adjudicated that fact. Second thing he's talking about is the defense's multiple false alibis theory. And Mr. Lopez was clear. The story he told was, I was with my girlfriend in my apartment. I walked across the street to Wilma Chavez's house, and that's where I was when I heard the gunshots. They broke that up into, I was with my girlfriend when I heard the gunshots, then I went to another house when I heard the gunshots. That's not the story that Mr. Lopez told him, and then Wilma Chavez came in and backed him up.
Well, regardless, as a legal matter, delays associated with the investigation do not qualify as extraordinary circumstances to violate the 48-hour rule of Riverside. The case is very plain on
absolutely.
That.
Absolutely, and Chicago has conceded that, as they must. So it was an adjudication of fact that actually didn't have any legal.
What type of argument occurred when the motion for directed verdict was made?
Well, there was a legitimate argument on the motion for directed verdict. It was the end of the last trial day, and it was maybe like.
I mean, were the cases that we're now discussing on appeal to raise at the trial level?
No. The one-page motion for directed verdict kind of motions.
That was the extent of the pleading.
Exactly, one or two pages. I don't want to over.
Did you urge the judge to reserve?
First of all, I moved for a directed verdict for Mr. Lopez on the 48-hour claim.
I understand.
And then in response to their directed verdicts, and there was never a directed verdict about nominal damages or anything like that, but in response to their directed verdicts, I said, Your Honor, I mean, my client got on the stand and testified he was shackled to a wall and starved. How can that not go to the jury? No one ever in the directed verdict arguments brought up the 14th Amendment. Both sides had agreed on the 4th Amendment, and there's a lot of good reason in the case law to think that it is a 4th Amendment case.
But no one suggested that the trial judge reserve on both and take it with
take it in consideration.
The jury.
No one made such an argument. Right. But we did when it became clear the following morning that the judge was granting a serious directed verdict, basically eviscerating the case. We asked him to give us an explanation, a chance to respond, and he wouldn't. My time is running short. There's a few other points I'd like to make briefly, and that is on the. It figures in with the diffusion of responsibility argument, which is that somebody in the Chicago Police Department must have been responsible for this. We had a very good Monell claim. We had developed evidence of other people that this happened to. Other people submitted affidavits that they were shackled and starved, and the judge granted Chicago's motion that we would not be allowed to prove that to the jury because they were going to stipulate to Monell liability. And at first, all they stipulated to was, we'll be responsible if there's a verdict against the individual defendants, and we said, uh-uh. Monell would say you're responsible if any employee of the city of Chicago violated Mr. Lopez's rights, and that is the stipulation that they eventually filed. That is the stipulation we went to trial on. So if there's somebody in the Chicago Police Department that was supposed to have made sure Mr. Lopez got fed, if there was somebody in the Chicago Police Department who should have known about the 48-hour rule, even though these detectives deny they knew what it was, then Chicago's on the hook.
Jury instructions using the Fourth Amendment standard were stipulated to as well?
We submitted jury instructions under the Fourth Amendment standard, citing the cases the plaintiff cited in his opening brief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kanowitz. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.